Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah News Roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Senator Mitt Romney is part of a bipartisan group to strike a deal on infrastructure spending. So what does the deal entail, and where is the money coming from to pay for it? A Utah congressman says that Republicans care about climate change, too, and launches something called the Conservative Climate Caucus. We've had a little rainfall over the last day or so. Severe drought continues, and so some municipalities are adopting fireworks restrictions to try to stave off wildfire. And the ongoing saga of the town of Hideout's attempted annexation of land in neighboring Summit County. Joining me for this conversation, all via Zoom this morning, we've got Salt Lake Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we've got government reporter Leah Larson. Welcome, Leah. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Of course. Always a pleasure. And news columnist Robert Gerke, good morning to you and welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Tweet to @KCPW or call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Matt Canham, there's this remote, rarely visited, and hard-to-find island, an island of American bipartisan cooperation, and that island is called infrastructure. One of the inhabitants of this island is Utah's own Senator Mitt Romney, and I could keep the joke going, but I think I'm going to drop it there and just say that for some time now, the idea of infrastructure spending has been this rare point of congressional agreement, but the two parties have become more and more divided, and even that rare point of common ground has been in question. Yesterday, though, a deal was announced to improve infrastructure in the United States of America. Two things. What do we mean by infrastructure? And then, yeah, what does this deal do, Matt?
So what do we mean by infrastructure? We are talking about roads and bridges. We're talking about railroads and buses, electrified buses, airports, ports, your water systems, your electricity systems, broadband. This is what they consider hard infrastructure. And that's what's in this bill that would spend $579 billion in new money on top of existing programs over the next 5 years. This deal was announced at the White House yesterday when a group of senators, including Senator Mitt Romney, met with President Joe Biden in the Oval Office. They came out as a group, a unified group, and stood in front of reporters and announced that they have a deal.
And that's interesting. So a deal on the spending to, you know, improve roads and bridges and all the rest of it. One of the sticking points on this deal has been, you know, how it was going to be paid for. President Biden has suggested that, you know, among other things, the way it would be paid for was by increasing taxes on the wealthy. Republicans have said, no, that's not how this is going to happen. And I know that the details are a little bit vague here, Matt, but how will this be paid for?
So if you're not raising taxes and you're trying to on the wealthy, and you're trying not to raise taxes on the middle class, what you do is a grab bag of different ways to pay for this. Some of this is siphoning money that was set aside for the coronavirus relief packages and put it towards this. Part of it is making it so the IRS has a better chance of getting money from corporations and the wealthy that they actually owe and just don't really pay. So they're working on that as well. You have attempts to reduce fraud in the unemployment insurance program. You can sell some of the strategic oil reserves or use tolls on bridges and roads. You cobble all this money together to try to pay for a package this big.
$529 billion, it is big, as you just said, but it's not nearly what President Biden was looking for, which was around $2 trillion. However, the president and his party, they will pursue other options to get the rest of that funding to happen. Can you explain that to us, Matt?
Go ahead.
Maybe not the rest of the exact infrastructure spending to happen, but they have other priorities that they want to get funded, and they have a sort of mechanism for doing that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a two-step process, and the president joined them together yesterday, which makes it more politically complicated. All the other stuff that Joe Biden wants, he put it in these big proposals like called the American Families Plan and stuff like that. They're going to have to go through what's called reconciliation. And this is a detailed process that starts with a budget resolution where all the Democrats have to agree on what they're aiming for, which is going to be hard on its own. And then they have to craft this bill that is huge. I mean, Senator Bernie Sanders is talking about $6 trillion, which I think is going to be, it's definitely not going to be that high, but it's going to be a lot of money and a very complicated bill that involve everything from childcare to much more expansive climate change programs. And then you have to get it passed by just Democratic votes, which obviously we might be easier than getting Republican votes, but to get every single Democrat in the Senate to vote for it is going to be a difficult challenge.
On that point, you know, the deal itself, the actual infrastructure deal, not the budget reconciliation that you just described, Senator Romney, well, he had some suggestions about how, you know, kind of the order of things here. And I've got a little clip on that. So this is Senator Romney in a Zoom conversation with Utah media yesterday on that point here. Take a quick listen.
If the Democratic leadership were to move on this first, I think it would pass with Republican and Democrat support, and it could pass in July. But if they go for reconciliation first, I think that has the potential to delay things a good deal.
And I guess that kind of, you know, hints at what you were describing, the fact that the reconciliation process is a little bit more complicated or more fraught. But I'm wondering if the order itself is something that might prevent, you know, if they bring up reconciliation first, this is really in the weeds here, Matt, but if that might prevent some Republicans from getting on board with it, if the fast track budget reconciliation process happens. Maybe there's a question for you. Can both of those things happen? And then, yeah, does the order of them, does that order matter?
The order matters definitely to Democrats. And so since they run the House and Senate, it matters to the chances of getting this passed. We have learned a little bit more since Senator Romney talked to reporters in Utah. And what the Democrats' plan is to take this bipartisan bill and have it come up for a vote in the Senate. And that will happen in July. And it will likely pass. Then the House is just going to sit on it and they're going to wait. What they want to see is they want to see the Senate also pass this big reconciliation package that Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are leading. And that is going to take until September, probably. Wow. So the new goal to pass all this is September 30th. That's because there are transportation funding mechanisms that expire if nothing's passed by then. So that's kind of a deadline. So you're going to see the Senate act on this bill most likely next month, and then we're going to have to grind this out. And it's really going to be a political fight to see, one, if the Democrats can come to terms amongst themselves, and two, do the Republicans supporting this bipartisan bill still vote for it when they know that its passage is linked to the passage of a much larger bill that they may not support?
Wow. It's interesting because there is this bipartisan agreement, and you know, the fact that there is, I mean, Senator Romney referred to this as being sort of a hopeful sign, the idea that Washington can work. Maybe let's bring in Robert Gerke on this, and Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. You know, this bipartisan deal, and then sort of separately, we talked about that fast track, you know, budget spending, the spending that doesn't fall into that deal, which will be significantly more than this deal itself. Just your overall take here. What do you think about this? Oh, and you are muted.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sorry. Can you hear me? I think it's encouraging because, you know, it's the type of compromise that we haven't seen in Washington for a while. And it's a big program, obviously. It's something that, you know, the joke for most of the Trump administration is this week's infrastructure week, right? And now we're finally seeing a little bit of progress on it. So I think it's encouraging. It's a hopeful sign. Obviously, there was give and take. And I think the senator addressed that yesterday when he spoke with media that, you know, it's nobody's, this isn't the bill that you know, either side wanted, but we might actually get something done, and we need it, frankly. I mean, you know, we've got a lot of infrastructure needs, roads, bridges, et cetera. And I think the broadband piece is exciting. So, I mean, I'm encouraging and I'm hopeful that they can get it across the finish line.
Okay. Yeah, and we didn't, I guess, Matt, we haven't gotten into like what this might mean specifically for the state of Utah. I don't know if we want to, there's other news to get to, but if there's a way to sort of encapsulate that. Yeah.
Yeah, I can say it quickly. A lot of this is going to be done by formula. So federal money that goes to roads and stuff and bridges is going to be parceled out to states based off existing formulas. But there is some money in this that might come to Utah more than, say, other states. If you're going to do, as Robert talked about, rural broadband access, we have a lot of rural areas in the state that could use some of that money. If you talk about water projects, the parched American West could get some extra money for water infrastructure. There are some things that Senator Romney thinks would definitely benefit Utah in here. We'll just have to see as more details come out.
Yeah. On that water point, just quickly, it seems like a lot of the talk from the president was about replacing, you know, lead pipes in communities around the country. I'm wondering if, well, I guess we would see how that money got apportioned out. But if water infrastructure projects mean something different in the West than it does in other places. But Matt, maybe we will leave it there unless you have comments on that.
No, that's great.
Okay. Okay, so let's turn to some other reporting that you did this week, Matt Canham, on our federal delegation as well. This is Representative John Curtis saying that climate change is a topic that Republicans need to embrace or to address. And to that end, he launched a new initiative this week. Explain what Representative Curtis is doing, Matt.
He has created what he calls the Conservative Climate Caucus. And caucuses in Congress can act in a lot of different ways. They can be rallying points for certain legislation. They could bring like-minded people together. This one is a little bit different than any I've covered before. The goal is not to get a bill passed. The goal is to create a safe space for Republicans to learn about climate change where they won't be demonized. 52 House Republicans have joined up. John Curtis says this group won't be endorsing bills, but they'll get briefings on them. They'll come up with ways that conservatives can talk about climate change in more productive ways when they are approached by voters or in town hall meetings. This is a modest effort, but an interesting one, an important one among conservative politics.
I guess so, you know, a safe space to have conversations, not endorsing any bills. So they don't have, this caucus is not going to come up with, say, specific plans for, you know, tackling carbon emissions that are driving and have caused climate change.
I'm sure individual members will, and John Curtis has signed on to bills that do that. But the group won't do it in this fashion. They will hear certain legislation. And they do, you know, they have signed on to a list of beliefs. So it's not like they don't have any framework. That beliefs include that climate change is real and that industries are contributing to the warming climate. But it also includes stuff that you might not hear on the liberal end of the climate change debate about the ongoing role of fossil fuels into our future. Or the idea that this is not about removing any one energy source. It's about studying all of them. So this is definitely going to be a conservative bent to the climate debate, but it does at least start with the idea that there is a problem that the government can't address.
There's also, and the government can address, but also maybe, I mean, from your reporting, it seems like the focus is on market-based, you know, solutions as opposed to direct government action or as, you know, as opposed to a carbon tax or policymaking that favors clean energy. And maybe this is a point to bring in the columnist again, Robert Gierke, for some opinions, because I'm wondering, Robert, if the unchecked market, I mean, if you think about market-based solutions being the focus as opposed to specific government actions to deal with this crisis, this existential threat, you know, if that's the right tack, maybe I'll just ask you that question.
Well, I mean, I think we've seen market forces driving a lot of climate reform in the last several years. I mean, we've seen Rocky Mountain Power, you know, embracing solar and wind energy, cleaner energy, closing coal plants. You know, that's largely the private sector, and the government can nudge them along in that direction. We've seen companies like Tesla developing batteries, but we've also seen the government investing heavily in battery research and so forth. So, I mean, I think there's obviously a place for it. It can't really be all one and not the other. And you know, as we said in the last segment, you know, this it's encouraging that there's maybe some opportunity for bipartisanship. And because what doesn't work, what we know doesn't work, is, you know, gridlock and doing nothing. So, you know, look, I don't think this conservative climate caucus is going to be the most, you know, visionary, you know, new Green Deal kind of group. But I think I think there's an opportunity for collaboration on some low hanging fruit, if nothing else.
I wonder if the sort of, I don't know, Trojan horse approach is, I mean, just going back to that last topic that we discussed, the infrastructure spending bill, and there's a lot of spending in there that is related to climate change. And actually, maybe I've got a clip here of Senator Romney. This is about a minute long clip talking about proposals on climate change that are in that infrastructure bill. Take a quick listen to that, and then we'll come back before we head to a break.
There is $48 billion for transit, and transit is designed, of course, to take roads off the highway, but also make travel easier for people who don't have automobiles. There's also $66 billion for rail, and that's primarily passenger rail, by the way. So again, that's taking people out of airplanes and taking people out of automobiles and getting them on rail. There is $47 billion for resiliency, and resiliency relates to protecting our lands from the impact of climate change, including wildfires and floods and coastal resiliency. There's also $73 billion in power investments, and that's upgrading our grid. It's spending, I think there's $5 billion for nuclear projects. There's $5 billion for hydrogen projects. As I recall, there's $5 billion for CO2 recapture from the air. So these are all important climate-related investments.
And I guess the reason I'm playing that is because this is government spending. Again, that's Senator Mitt Romney in a call with Utah media yesterday. But spending on you know, it's for infrastructure, but baked into that spending is the idea that we, through our government, are making choices through, you know, about what we're trying to do with our future. And it's slightly different than, I guess, the market-based solutions idea that the Conservative Climate Caucus is coming up with. But maybe, I guess, Robert Grieco, the very fact that there is something called the Conservative Climate Caucus, you know, despite the fact that we've known about this problem for quite a long time, is maybe a good sign.
Well, I mean, I think Representative Curtis in particular has been talking about this issue since he got elected, really. You know, he has said that he doesn't think Republicans should be, you know, on the sidelines on this. And so, you know, it's good to see him getting in the game. Like I said, he's been talking about it for many years, hasn't really advanced a lot of, you know, bold initiatives, but again, I think it's a start. I think there's potential there. And I think anytime, especially in our current political climate, that there's an opening for bipartisanship, then I think we should welcome that. Again, we just haven't seen much of that. And so if that's what they're looking for, if this can yield some results along those lines, then I think it's worth a shot.
It's interesting. I mean, we need to head to a break, but we've known for, again, a really long time what is needed to address global warming. I remember being taught about the greenhouse effect when I was in elementary school back in the 1980s. Not a mystery. We have to substantially reduce carbon emissions. And I guess we'll see whether or not we get there. Matt Canham, I know that we have to let you go. Anything to add on this story here?
You know, we'll be able to see if this locally, if this conservative climate caucus is successful. All four members of Utah's delegation are on this. So while we know where John Curtis has stood, we could start watching how Representative Chris Stewart, Representative Burgess Owens talk about this topic. Does their language change? And I think that might be a sign of whether this caucus has made an impact or not.
Okay, that's Salt Lake Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham, who we have to say goodbye to. Matt Canham, thanks for making time for the show today.
Happy to be here. Hope you have a great show. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. When we come back, we will talk about fireworks. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in just a minute.
Support for Project Resilience programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and USU Center for Persons with Disabilities, working to create healthy, inclusive communities through innovative research, service, technical assistance, and education. Information at cpd.usu.edu. Support also comes from the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, performing Mozart's Requiem, 1 p.m., Saturday, July 10th, at the Ellen Eccles Theater. Proceeds from the concert will benefit the Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. Ticket information at utahfestival.org. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Leah Larson and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Leah Larson, we will now turn to your reporting. Some municipalities in the state of Utah are banning fireworks or trying to do that. And the reason that they're doing that is that it's been exceptionally dry and hot. We're in this terrible drought. There has been a debate, though, about, you know, or over who can and who can not make the call to ban these, you know, pyrotechnic products, I guess. And that debate is where I want to start. The governor, Utah Governor Spencer Cox, has said that he can't ban fireworks, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. This has become sort of a political hot potato, I would say. So the governor started out by saying, you know, legally he cannot enact a statewide ban, that would be up to the legislature. But a lot of lawmakers have been sort of punting to the cities saying, hey, citizens, if you want a fireworks ban in your community, reach out to your mayor and your city councils. But then meanwhile, the city councils are saying, actually, the statute doesn't allow us to do this. At least some cities have said that.
Meaning Utah law, the lawmakers are saying, you know, go to your city, ask your city to do something. And the people in the city are saying, actually, go back to your lawmakers because the law doesn't let us do what you're asking us to do. Is that about right?
Yeah. So the law does kind of tie municipalities' hands a bit. It allows them to enact limited restrictions where there's hazardous environmental conditions, like in wilderness areas, along waterways, maybe where there's, you know, a lot of dry brush, but not in a citywide ban.
Okay. Nevertheless, you know, some municipalities, some cities are banning fireworks or trying to ban fireworks. Here in Utah, the capital city, here in Utah's capital city, Salt Lake City, the mayor and fire chief, they said, yeah, we're banning personal fireworks. What does this ban do? What are the details here, Leah?
So yeah, just that, like any of the personal fireworks that you would get at, you know, those fireworks stands that you see at grocery stores and things, the sparklers, the rockets, those are not allowed in city limits at any point.
Okay. And I guess, you know, can I actually just maybe ask for the general rules on fireworks, meaning when are you allowed to you know, generally, if there weren't these bans in place, to light off fireworks, during what hours and what period of time of the year?
That is a great question. So if you're in a non-restricted area, you can light fireworks from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. on July 2nd to July 5th and July 22nd to July 25th. And then on Independence Day and Pioneer Day, those hours are extended from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m.
to 12 or 12 a.m., I guess, to midnight.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah, to midnight. Exactly.
Things switch over. And then there are penalties, I guess, for if you are someone who lights a firework when you're not supposed to. Yeah, there's obviously penalties. And can you talk about that? And then beyond the penalties, I guess you could be responsible for damage as well.
Yeah, exactly. So you could face a Class B misdemeanor, fines of $1,000. And then, like you said, any damage, like if you were to light someone's house on fire, you know, light the hillside on fire, they can come after you to recover those costs.
And that's something, I mean, I think this feels a little bit obvious, but fireworks do wreak a lot of havoc in Utah. And this is something that you talk about in one of your articles, that there are these downsides, and I think that people maybe don't realize how much damage they cause. They've been responsible for some pretty significant damage, and obviously there's the risk of loss of life too. Can you talk about that, Leah?
Oh yeah, I mean they're explosives, right? They are dangerous. It seems every year there's some story about, you know, wildfire set off by somebody's personal fireworks, or someone's house getting burned, or you know, someone getting injured, ending up in the ER on Independence Day from fireworks. It just seems like every year there's one or two of those stories.
Hey, Leah, there's also, in addition to the fireworks ban here in Salt Lake City, there's the fire marshal and the mayor said we're banning burning of a certain kind. It was sort of recreational burning or burning for cooking. Can you explain what the rules are there?
You know, that's not something that I've reported on, so I'm probably not the best person to ask that.
Got it.
Sorry.
Okay, no, you're fine. It's interesting. Robert Gricke.
As I understand it, it's just open fires are prohibited, so like your gas grill is okay, but you can't have those, you know, those fire pits or things like that. Open flame of any sort is prohibited in the city limits and in most of these jurisdictions that are restricting burning and fire and fireworks.
Okay. And Robert, just while you're, you know, while we've got you on the line here, I guess, you know, some people really love fireworks. Some of us really hate them. Can I just ask what you think should be happening here? What do you think the state should be doing facing the severe drought, hot conditions, the threat of wildfire? And again, you know, loss of life, et cetera. I mean, you've got, impacts to wildlife, to pets, to residents, the potential, you know, death of firefighters and residents. I guess this probably sounds curmudgeonly, but I'm one of those who thinks, is it really worth it? What do you think should be happening?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly become a hot issue this year, and I think it's probably a little bit more incendiary, if I can use the term, this year than in normal years, because we kind of lost the 4th and the 24th last year, right? Because of COVID. And so this is going to be our first year in a while that we've had the opportunity to celebrate these holidays. I think people are a little bit more on edge about government mandates and the government telling them what to do, you know, after we've come out of the mask mandates and so forth. So I think the heat's turned up on the issue in a way that it hasn't been before. There's always been a divide about people who like fireworks and don't like fireworks. I mean, air quality issues and so forth have always been topics that have been discussed, but it just, I'm kind of with you. It feels like this year in particular, the conditions are just so, so dry, notwithstanding the rain we got yesterday, that this is a bad idea in cities. And this is why we have government to step in and protect people's homes, property, welfare, lives. You know, as Leah mentioned, there were 65, I've also seen the number 68 fires ignited by fireworks last year. You know, and this year conditions are much worse. And you know, I've talked to mayors who are worried that we could see some one of these Oregon fire scenarios like we had where the wiped out towns, you know, if it gets into the tree canopy and so forth. So, you know, I think it's important that we have the restrictions. I had early on advocated for the governor taking the lead on this through an emergency order. Obviously, he said he doesn't have the authority to do that. So that leaves it to these city councils. And I think a lot of them are stepping up, you know, Salt Lake, South Salt Lake, Ogden. A lot of these cities have imposed restrictions. Mill Creek has expanded the restrictions it had last year. Sandy added some turf to its band earlier this year. And there's a good set. If people are curious, there's a good map, interactive map that the state fire marshal has and Unified Fire Authority showing where fireworks are restricted. I just think it's got to be done. I just think there's too much risk this year. And, you know, and then the question becomes enforcement, which is really difficult. You can't have, you know, officers everywhere at all times, you know, babysitting everybody. There are tip lines that have been set up, and I think those are, it's really the only practical way to maintain some sort of control over this.
I mean, yeah, if you go outside in the middle of July and look out over the valley, you can see fireworks all over the place. In regular years, I guess, Leah, you reported, I know that there's, as Robert pointed out, the map, and then there's the tip line. But yeah, I guess the idea that officers could go to every specific place where someone calls to say, hey, my neighbor lit off an illegal firework is tough. Leah, I'm, you know, we didn't mention this, but Salt Lake City, as we said, has banned personal fireworks. They still have some official fireworks shows going on, some displays happening, correct?
Yeah. They're having their regular fireworks shows at Liberty Park, I think is one. I can't remember where the second one is, but yeah, the city-sponsored fireworks shows will go on.
Okay. Robert Gerke, anything to add here? We have other reporting to get to, but just on the topic of fireworks, I always think of my dog. I mean, this is the thing that I'm trying to protect is the dog that freaks out about fireworks.
Yeah, my dogs don't like him either. I mean, I just think that, you know, even if you are in one of these areas where they are permitted and you're going to be lighting them, just be really careful. And, you know, if you see a fire starting, call somebody immediately, because we can't afford to let anything get out of control this year. You remember big fire down on the ridgeline in Draper last year that was threatening homes, 12,000 acres burned in Washington County last year because of fireworks. And so we've just got to be extra careful this year.
Okay. All right. A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And Leah Larson, I want to turn to some other another story that you covered this week. It's an update to the ongoing saga of the town of Hideout. You know, because this show goes all over the state, and also because I think that local listeners might not know this either, where is Hideout? And then maybe what's the brief history of why they started making news beginning about a year ago? Those two questions rolled into one.
Yeah. So Hideout is a small little town above the Dordanelle Reservoir in Wasatch County. And they're looking to diversify their tax base because they are so small and they're only getting residential property taxes. So they want to grow, but they're kind of hemmed in by mountains, by the reservoir. So there was a short-lived bill in the legislature that allowed Hideout to reach across county lines into Summit County and annex all this land there without the county's consent. And the county in their master plan had wanted to keep this land, which is located in an area called Richardson Flat, just east of Park City. Their master plan, they had wanted to keep it open space or really light development, light residential. So they were not happy about this. So they have been suing Hideout, suing their developer. And then just this week, a judge ruled in favor of Summit County that Hideout had not done this annexation properly, and we can talk about that more if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, it's
very, very convoluted, very complicated.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you said that the reason that Hideout wants to grow was to, you know, increase the property tax base. But as you said, there's a developer involved. There's obviously big money to be made here as well. Let's do that. The latest in this story, it has to do with, as you said, that ruling by a judge, but there's also a vote by residents of the town. Both of those things occurred on the same day, and they're kind of contradictory things. Sure. Well, let's get the convoluted picture. What happened earlier this week?
So this, you know, this annexation has been pretty controversial, even among residents of Hideout. As this town has been kind of, you know, embroiled in lawsuits with Summit County, there was this movement to have a referendum vote on whether they should rescind the annexation to kind of get the residents of Hideout's opinions on whether they want to move forward with this. So that vote was on Tuesday. And like I said, Hideout's a tiny town, but there was 178 votes in favor of annexation and 87 against. So pretty overwhelming support that this is what the residents want, despite the controversy. But on the same day, a judge came out and said that the town council had basically missed a deadline to enact this annexation properly. Because what had happened is when the legislature heard that Hideout was doing this, they met in special session and they repealed the provision that allowed them to reach across county lines and take land without the county's consent. So that that left Hideout with this really short window to do the annexation before that law went into effect.
Can you, I can't remember, I think you hinted at this, but when the bill or when the sort of provision was put into Utah code that allowed a town to annex a portion of land, like when, how long had that been on Utah's books?
Oh, I mean, just a few months.
Okay.
And, you know, as soon as, yeah, I mean, not long at all.
Can I ask, was that bill tailor-made for Hideout to do what it was doing? Was that the purpose of this bill?
I think that's what Summit County would argue.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. So I guess at this point, there's the, you know, the ruling from the judge. Is that the thing that I guess has the, you know, has primacy? Obviously, there's a vote by residents, but there's a judge who's saying Summit County is right here. Does that put an end to this tale? Where do we go from here, Leah?
Well, this town has said it will appeal, so it's going to go to a higher court, and we'll see what they decide as the saga, as you called it, continues. But yeah, if that higher court rules in Summit County's favor, that would null the entire annexation, so then the residents' vote would also be null. Hmm.
Robert Gerke, news columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, have you been following this tale? It does... From an outsider's perspective, you know, just following the news, sometimes it feels a little bit like a land grab, but one that was done in a legal way. I mean, in the fact that it was done through the state legislature. What do you think of this tale?
Well, I mean, the whole thing has been has kind of stunk from the start. I mean, these developers, including Josh Romney, had been trying to develop this land with the county for a long time. They couldn't get what they wanted. So they got this provision added to the law at the last minute. Even the sponsor said he didn't know what it did, but the lobbyist for these developers brought it to this legislator, and he sponsored it anyway. And so, you know, the whole thing has kind of been about, you know, gaming the system, and Hideout has been trying to do that. I don't think any of us want to lose that sort of local control, self-government piece of it, just because, as Leah said, 178, I believe, residents in a neighboring town want to build something in your backyard. It's that's not the way it should work. And so, you know, this is, I think if this judge's opinion is upheld, which I'm not an attorney, but it looks to me like it should be. You know, if it is upheld, then we can go back to hit the reset button and start over and get this done right in a way that represents not just the few residents of the town of Hideout, but all the residents in Park City and Summit County. I think it's important to do this right if it's going to get done at all.
Leah, just on the annexation question, I mean, to me, I'm wondering, if for the developer and for the town, if when you annex land, if that costs you anything, I mean, maybe there's some fees or something, but the money you stand to make from, you know, however much, let me ask that question first. Is, you know, if you annex land, are you paying any money for that land?
Well, the developers own the land, so I guess, you know, they'll sell it off to homeowners as they build homes. You know, commercial property owners.
Sure.
I think the town would acquire, they want to build a town hall. Like, they want to make it their city center, essentially. So I guess the town would have to acquire some of it that way. But
Leah, did the developers own the land prior to the annexation, I guess, is the question that I have. Meaning, was the ownership conferred by annexation, or did they pay somebody some money for that land?
Yes. So the developers do own the land, although that is also the subject of a lawsuit because Summit County is contending that Wells Fargo and the developers, you know, illegally brought in this constable from a different county that wasn't authorized to work in Summit County to like initiate this subdivision of parcels that was the county didn't authorize. So like I said, it's very convoluted.
Well, it's an interesting tale. I mean, it kind of sounds like an old West tale, and I find it fascinating, and thank you for your coverage on it. Leah Larson is a government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and we are going to take another break in the show. We will come back with more from this past week in Utah news and also with our underplayed stories of the week. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we talked summer cooking, including, yes, how to feed everyone while on vacation, with award-winning cookbook author Carla Lally Music. And we dive into the sweet shaved ices of Asia with Food & Wine's Khushbu Shah. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Sunday at noon here on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Jay Allison, producer of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us for our show here on Utah Public Radio, with true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world. Moth shows are renowned for the range of human experience they reveal. That's the Moth Radio Hour, Saturday evening at 6, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson and Robert Gerke. This show is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting and writing from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK or by tweeting to @KCPW. Leah Larson, just since we have a little bit more time on the show, I want to get to one more story that you wrote this week, which was about the new Salt Lake City airport. It has gotten some negative comments from people, especially from, I think, locals, and the airport director says that he's trying to address those concerns. Yeah, you know, maybe give us the overview of the new airport. I haven't been there yet myself, so I really don't know how bad it is, or alternatively, how overblown these concerns are. I guess, what kinds of complaints is the airport are people lodging against the airport? I guess is the question.
It seems like every time we do a story on the airport, even if it's just like, "Hey, airlines are resuming service again" or something, people get in the comments or go on social media and complain about the long walk involved. Like, people really don't like the long walk involved. I mean, this is not the old Salt Lake City International where, you know, there were three little tiny terminals and you could show up, you know, 30 minutes before your flight departs and like be at your gate. It's a lot bigger now. There is a long walk involved. There is not a train or what airport people call people mover. Right. So yeah, get ready to hoof it.
That's the major complaint. I'm assuming the airport says that it's trying to, I guess, address some of the issues. Is there much they can do in the short term? I know that there's also a component of the story that has to do with the Trax line. What is the airport doing?
I mean, so much. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that the airport is still unfinished. It's like just in its first phase of opening. So there are two concourses and they are connected by an underground tunnel. And right now it's kind of a small, skinny tunnel, but they're building a humongous tunnel that will be like the long-term permanent tunnel. And eventually that's going to have a train in it.
Okay.
And then they'll extend the concourses so the airport's even bigger. But that's a lot of what's causing, I mean, there's some confusion with wayfinding. It's like you walk into the main hall after you go through security and you immediately go left, which is a little confusing. But eventually that will be in the center of things. I don't know how to explain it, but eventually the terminal will be in the center. But right now it just feels very counterintuitive, I guess.
I get it. The design doesn't yet match what it's supposed to be, and so it gets confusing. Maybe I'll bring in Robert Gerke. I mean, Robert, have you been to the new airport yet, news columnist?
I haven't, but I had some folks come through last week, and they said that according to their little Fitbit thing, it was about 4,000 steps from you know, from parking the car to getting to their gate. So it is a long walk and you need to prepare for it and build in some extra time. But I also, I would imagine that these hiccups are not entirely unexpected and hopefully in the future it improves and becomes, you know, an asset to the community. Right now it does sound like it's a bit of a pain in the neck. Okay. Or pain in the feet.
Pain in the feet. 4,000 steps. Maybe it's a sort of public health initiative at the same time, getting people to walk more. I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah, I like it. Hey, so we have a little bit more time. And Robert Grycki, I actually want to bring you back into the conversation here because I want to talk about vaccine incentives just briefly. And that is because the state of Utah has seen a plateau in, in the number of vaccinations that are occurring in the state. And we need to get more people vaccinated. But, you know, as things are slowing, you wrote a column today, just today, or that published today, about the fact that incentives to get people vaccinated work. But are we seeing those here in Utah?
Yeah, well, there's some research that has been done where they ask people who had been unvaccinated if they'd be more likely to get vaccinated with just even a small incentive, and a third of them said that they would, and so that's higher than other methods of trying to convince people to do this. And so, it seems like it would make sense, but the legislature back in May, when they met in the special session, included a rider in a budget bill that said no state money can be used for vaccines. So they've really slammed the door on this. And I asked legislative leaders, well, what do you suggest as an alternative? And their answer was basically just more of the same, more education, more, making it easy for people. And we've just reached a point where, the governor wanted to get 70% of adults one shot by July 4th. If at the current rate we're going, we're not going to get 70% of the people one shot until Columbus Day. It's going to be mid-October before we get there. And so with variants spreading, with cases on the rise, it seems like there is a little bit of urgency to try to, move this along. So I think incentives would be great. And again, unfortunately, the legislature has said that they're not going to allow that. And so what I suggest is, maybe the business community can once again step in and pick up the slack from the legislature where, people, I was suggesting jazz tickets if the jazz hadn't been eliminated, something like that, a drawing for maybe even like a truck or a car or something like that. Something that's kind of big, but can kind of excite people a little bit more and get them, get the jabs in the arms. Washington State allows marijuana dispensaries to give people a joint. I don't think we're going to go there, but they call it joints for jabs, which I think is pretty clever. But there is room for us to think outside the box a little bit more than we have. And try to leverage some of these resources.
Yeah, and I mean, hey, you could have the jazz tickets for next year, kind of voucher or whatever. But what about whatever happened to the idea of there being a a lottery? It was something that the Governor Cox sort of suggested Utah could do. That just didn't happen in the legislature, I guess.
Yeah, this was patterned after Ohio's Vax-a-Million program, where they've given away four $1 million awards. Some places are giving away scholarships to younger people to try to get younger people vaccinated. There's a lot of things that can be done with state money, but again, the legislature has just said no state money for any incentive, award, or gift. And so the Senate president told me that he believes that a lottery like Ohio did would be unconstitutional. There's obviously some dispute to that because the statute says you have to basically buy a ticket or risk some money of something of value in order to win the prize. That's what makes it gambling, and this obviously wouldn't be something that you would have to buy into necessarily. And as I said in my column, I think the real gamble at this point is not getting vaccinated. So I think legally they could have done it, but I think the legislature said that they don't want to do it, and part of it I think is that they don't want to alienate the anti-vax base. There are people out there who are very passionate about it, and they don't want to upset them by using state money to try to get people to do the right things. Hopefully, ideally, people would be doing this on their own. We've seen over and over that the vaccines work. And in fact, yesterday, again, the state released numbers that said there have only been 3 breakthrough deaths since we started the vaccination program. That's 1.3 million people have been vaccinated. It's a very small percentage of the overall cases that where people who have been vaccinated get this. So they work. They keep people out of the hospital. They keep people from dying. They keep people from getting sick. That should be enough, it would seem, but it's not. And so, you know, I think there's, you know, we got to do something to move this along. And so that's why, again, I think the business community could maybe step in and pick up some of the slack.
Yeah, being guided by that, you know, loud sort of anti-vax, you know, anti-public health base is, doesn't seem like a great way to do policy making. But Robert Gerke, thank you for your column on that. I'm going to just, because we're low on time, I'm going to turn us to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. This is where we highlight a story that maybe didn't get a lot of play, or we just want to highlight otherwise. And Leah Larson, have you got a pick for underplayed story?
I do. My story is by reporter Shelley Mesh about why it's pretty much impossible to buy a bike right now due to the pandemic.
Wow.
And I will say, as a person who likes bikes, not only is it hard to get a bike, it's hard to get bike parts.
Wow. Yeah, I saw this article, and the fact that, you know, if you want to get a bike right now, you have to shell out $1,000 or more, you know, even for your kid's bike. Really interesting pick. Thank you for that pick, Leah Larson. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, I'm going to highlight one that by Taylor Stevens that just posted yesterday evening. This Salt Lake City is bringing on new housing, new apartments for homeless people. They estimate it'll bring in at least 65 homeless people into a subsidized or no rent apartment building that's opening in downtown. And again, this is just another step in what we've been trying to do to try to get homeless people homes. And that's the ultimate solution, right? To the homeless issue is getting a roof over their head. So this is another step. It's an interesting one. These apartments look pretty nice. And I think it's probably a good move and worth checking out at sltrib.com.
Check that out. For my part, well, this isn't actually a Tribune story, but I'm going to go with last night's combined no-hitter for the Chicago Cubs. Combined no-hitter is where multiple pitchers pitch a no-hitter, and it's, you know, a no-hitter, if you watch baseball, you know that it's very rare. A combined no-hitter is even rarer, and I guess that's because you generally don't pull a pitcher who's throwing a no-hitter. Four pitchers combined to make this happen for the Cubs. This game was against the Los Angeles Dodgers. I actually only watched the highlights, but my parents are diehard Cubs fans, and my dad sent me a note with some statistics, among them the fact that this was the first combined no-hitter in Cubs history, and that history goes back to 1890. So kind of a cool story there. That's my pick. Leah Larson and Robert Gerke, both with Salt Lake Tribune. Really appreciate your coverage, and thanks for joining us on the show today.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Of course, you too. Thanks as well to Matt Canham, who joined us earlier. That is our show for today. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or whatever app you use to get your podcasts. Yeah. Enjoy the weekend. Join us again next week. Thanks for listening.
Support for Utah Public Radio programming comes from our members and Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater, July 7th through July 31st in Logan, with performances of Souvenir, 33 Variations, The Fantastics, and I Do, I Do. Details and tickets at utahfestival.org. Support also comes from the USU Lyric Repertory Company, presenting All the Way, a prequel to 2019's presentation of The Great Society, depicting LBJ's first term in office as he works to establish the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Performances through July 17th. Details at lyricrep.org.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Ridgefield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.